Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
My name's Hugh Broughton. I'm the director and founder of Hugh Broughton Architects, and we're here today in my studio in West London.
On the programme this week is Hugh Broughton. Hugh is perhaps best known for his practice's work designing the British Antarctic Survey's Halley 6 research station. Its bright red and blue modules, set atop large hydraulic stilts, loom large over the glistening white Antarctic landscape. The research station's iconic outline has entered the popular imagination, having featured both on the front of a Royal Mail stamp and the back of a £2 coin. More recently, the station featured on a BBC Horizon documentary, which covered the extraordinary process of moving the building. After university in Edinburgh, and a brief spell working for John McCaslin, Hugh founded his own practice in 1996. Following their successful work for the British Antarctic Survey, the practice went on to forge an enviable track record for their other work in remote and polar regions, as well as work closer to home on a string of cultural and heritage projects. In this week's episode, we talk about the chilly task of designing for the Antarctic, about working for NASA, and about the architect's role as a marriage counsellor. We discuss the joys of winning competitions and the pain of losing them. And we consider the benefits and necessity of having many strings to your bow. In warm and comfortable surroundings in West London, I started by asking Hugh about his move to his current offices.
Oh, in this studio, we moved here, I think it was about 2007 or 8.
Okay.
And we moved here when we won the commission for the Antarctic Research Station, because
right.
We were working in a kind of outbuilding in Olympia.
Okay.
And it was pretty tight. I mean, there were about 10 of us in a space that was probably, I don't know, 500-600 square feet. So we were really on top of each other.
Okay.
So the time came when, you know, you just couldn't bear it any longer.
Yeah. Was that training for working in Antarctica?
Yeah, probably.
Being on top of...
And also, apart from one or two people, everybody worked in a line looking at a wall. So we didn't find that was very good for the psyche either.
No. Exactly. You set up the firm in 96.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, sort of roughly. So what happened is I used to work for a firm called Troughton McCaslin. It's probably, which was the precursor of John McCaslin and Partners.
Yeah.
And I left there in 1994,
okay.
Which is when I got married. And my wife and I thought it would be really fun to have an adventure when we first got married. So we moved to Spain. And it just so happened that just before moving to Spain, John McCaslin had asked me to go and give a talk on his behalf in Paris, and about the use of steel in architecture.
Okay.
And he was due to do it, but he had some other call on his time. I think he had to go to the States or something. And so I turned up at this conference. It was in La Défense in Paris. And I was shown to a small little meeting room. I thought, that's great, nice little seminar, you know, kind of like 7 or 8 people, that'll be fine. But no, this was the room where you tried your slides out. And then I got ushered into this lecture theatre, which sat 2,000 people all having simultaneous translation. And I thought, oh my God, this is too much. Anyway, I did my talk. And then that evening, there was a dinner up the Eiffel Tower. And I sat next to the engineer, Anthony Hunt, and his wife. And all the English people who had spoken were all on the table together. And it was absolutely fantastic. And I explained to Tony Hunt how I wanted to go and work in Spain. And he said, oh, I've always wanted to get a job in Spain. And he had just recently become the chairman of YRM. And so I wrote to him afterwards and he said, oh, well, great. You know, you can go and be our sort of forward ambassador for setting up an office in Spain. So that's the job I got, was researching the Spanish market for YRM. And I did that for about 8 or 9 months. And we did come up with some fantastic leads, including the Madrid Barajas Airport, because YRM had just recently done Gatwick Airport.
Yeah.
But then everything went wrong for YRM at that stage, and they were a listed company, and they retracted significantly, right. And they couldn't follow up. And in the end, of course, that was the project that Richard Rogers won. But Anthony Hunt was the structural engineer, so I suppose there was some benefit for them out of it. And then after that, I then, after they sort of stopped paying our bills for being in Spain, I then got another job. And that was writing, there was this company, Ellipsis, who used to produce little grey guides to modern architecture of the cities of, actually it was of the world. And I got the job to do Madrid. So we were based in Barcelona and then we moved to Madrid. And then for 5 or 6 months, I just went around looking at the 100 best buildings in Madrid, meeting the architects of the 100 best buildings, writing short little descriptions. My wife did all the details to do with how to get there on the bus and the tube and what the address was and all that kind of thing. And it was just a fantastic thing. And then one day we went to the bank to draw some money out and they said there was none left. So then it was time to come home again.
But after an amazing...
After an amazing experience. And that was where I picked up my very, very first job, in that our landlady of the apartment we lived in Madrid owned another apartment in the centre of Madrid, and she wanted to split it into three flats. And so she gave me that job. So that was my first job, actually, was a job in Madrid. And sadly, it didn't get built. Uh-huh. But it was when I came back, not only did I have to write up the guidebook to the modern architecture, but I also had this small apartment project to get going on, and that's what sort of facilitated the start of the practice, I suppose.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was around about, it was about 94, 95. The first decent job I got, however, was one day I used to work from my bedroom, you know, all good startups. And one Friday evening, I used to have a friend of mine who used to ring me up, you know, and take the mickey out of me running my own practice and pretend he was offering me to design the new, you know, World Trade Center or whatever it was. And he used to ring particularly on Friday evenings. Right. So the phone rang Friday evening. I thought, oh yeah, here we go. It's Michael again. And it was this guy on the phone said, Hugh Broughton Architects, I'm looking for your small works department.
I
said, oh yes, I'll put you through, but I think they're all being small at the moment. Right. And he went, oh, sorry. Yeah. And then I said, I thought you were someone else. Hello, how can I help? And it was a public health engineer from Arabs. And they were looking for an architect to assist them with the refurbishment of all the toilets in Congress House, which is the headquarters of the TUC. Mm-hmm. And because they were public health engineers, they hadn't had a great deal of contact with architects, unlike if it had been a structural engineer from Arabs, who probably would have known hundreds of architects to ring up. But this chap had gone, in fact, to the RIBA to get a recommendation of an architect who could help with a small project, but on a post-war listed building. And Troughton McCaslin, I'd worked on the De La Warr Pavilion with John. And so I had that experience. And so my first kind of real commission, I guess, was doing up the toilets for the TUC. And in fact, that was at the end of 95, beginning of 96. And we're now in our 21st year of working for the TUC. So it's I've had that client ever since.
Get the toilets right and they'll keep you coming back.
Well, the original architect of that building, David Aberdeen, he worked on that project for a long time because there was a postponement between when he won the competition and when it started on site. But I think even he was only working on it for 10 years. So I've worked on it for twice as long as the original architect, which is bizarre. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer to a simple question.
That's what we like, good answers. I mean, I was interested to explore some of the time with Troughton McCaslin. Did you meet, you both at John McCaslin, you both at Edinburgh?
I didn't know John at Edinburgh, no. He was a few years ahead of me. Okay. But the reason, how I met John was fun because I used to organise all the lectures for architects who would come up and talk about their careers for the Student Architecture Society in Edinburgh. Right. So we invited John up to do a talk. And normally the architects who came up from London would stay the night and you'd go out for them with the evening. I think John did that and we had fun. And then quite soon after, he entered a competition to redesign Waverley Station in Edinburgh. Yeah. And they wanted a drawing where they could show their proposals in the context of the elevation of the whole of Princes Street, which is quite long.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of buildings on it. So they rang up and they said, would you and a bunch of your students do us 1 to I can't remember if it was 1 to 500 or 1 to 200 elevation of Princes Street, and we'll pay you for it. Yeah. So we were right in the middle of our course, so we abandoned all work that we were doing on any projects for university.
There was
a group of four, I think there was four of us, and we spent 2 weeks drawing up the elevation of Princes Street. It was actually a fantastic drawing. And then they would then impose their proposals for the station over the top of that so they could show it in context. And then having done that, obviously we had established contact with their office. And then when I came to the end of my course, I just rang him up and said, oh, any chance of a job? And came in for an interview and he gave me a job. So that's how I started working with
him. Straight out of university.
I've always had a... it was a fantastically good grounding. And I was thrown into... not only working on the Dillawall Pavilion, but there was actually a pedestrian footbridge that crossed over from Waterloo Station to Waterloo East Station that was my project. Yeah. And I got to run these things, you know, really at a young age. It was a brilliant experience. And since I've set up my own office, John's been very generous introducing me to other projects. He recommended us for a project for Derwent London, for example. Right. And Jamie Troughton has been a kind of, you know, really key player in the development of our office. I've done projects with him. He comes in as a mentor to look at things. So, yeah, I was very lucky, I think.
Wow, okay.
But there's another architect I'd also got to mention as well, because I did my year out. So I think it shows how important these early career moves are for architects, where you work, who you work for. Yeah, it's a really important decision because I think it's the... provides such an important foundation as to how your career develops. And so I guess there's a degree of luck, but if you can identify architects who are going to give you, you know, a lot of their time, a lot of help and support you, you know, then and going forward, it does make a big difference. So the other architect that I was so lucky to work for in my year out was Michael Mansa, and who obviously was once the president of the RIBA, sadly passed away last year. But Michael was absolutely fantastic. So there were two of us, in fact, who were taken on as Part 1 students at his office. Right. And then we both worked there in subsequent summers. And he was just brilliant at telling you what was going on, asking your opinion, engaging you in conversation. Right. I think it was a sort of, it's a, you know, a lot of people know a lot about Michael. Yeah. But one of the sides was his just fantastic mentorship that he gave to young people that worked in his office.
Wow.
So I think both of those practices in different ways, you know, really formative and really helpful as well.
And that was whilst you were at university with Michael.
Yeah.
So Edinburgh for part one.
Yeah, and part two.
Part two.
Yeah.
What did you do? What was before Edinburgh? I mean, what led you to become
an architect?
Become an architect, yeah.
I used to really like drawing.
Right.
Sort of like little stick men of, you know, like, I don't know, when I first started, it was like armies. And then I like kind of drawing, you know, buildings. Right. And I think my mum said, oh, as far as I know, the best career for people who like drawing is architecture.
Yeah.
So that's how I kind of got into it. And the first year or two I was at Edinburgh, I have to admit, I just did not get it. And there was a friend of mine who was there. He was absolutely brilliant. A guy called Kim Kwasi, now works at Arup Associates. And he just was streets ahead of the rest of us in understanding what was required of a student of architecture. And I just thought that, you know, surely every building was entirely symmetrical, two up, two down. And that's how you design things. And I remember we had a project for a house by a lake in the Scottish Borders, a site which I would just die for now. Yeah, and I did do a sort of two up, two down with a pitch roof on the top. And I couldn't understand why I got such a bad grade for it. Uh-huh. And of course, he did this amazing reinterpretation of falling water or something like that. And it was absolutely magnificent. And then I had my sort of road to Damascus moment. I went on a holiday with a friend of mine at the end of second year, and we went to South America, and we went kind of like trekking amongst the ruins of the Andes, about to Machu Picchu and, you know, all the various Inca ruins. And I suddenly got this kind of insight as to how, you know, people built with the landscape and out of the landscape in these incredible structures that were, you know, made of stone without any mortar or anything like that. And all of a sudden there was this kind of click as to how buildings could relate to their environment. And I did a little better after that.
Yeah. And that, again, I suppose the kind of the travel then and the kind of formative experience then of leading on to some of the Antarctic work.
It's quite interesting, actually, because when I did, after I left school, I had a year out. I taught at a small school in the south of India, and we did quite a bit of travelling around, me and the other guy who went there. And we did go and visit some fairly seminal architectural masterpieces, you know, not only the older stuff, the Red Fort and all those kind of things, but actually we went on a trip to Bangladesh, and it was just after Louis Kahn's National Assembly in Dhaka had been finished, and we went to visit that. And without really understanding anything about the significance of Louis Kahn, you know, I did find that building, you know, really stirring. I mean, it's an absolutely extraordinary structure, particularly in a country which at that stage was so impoverished. And it's without realizing the importance of it, you then find, you know, 10 years later, you go back to look at it and think, oh, I get why I found that so important, you know.
Without knowing particularly about Louis Kahn.
Yeah, exactly.
So on to Edinburgh. And then on to work for John McCaslin.
Oh, I should probably talk about Edinburgh. It's because at the time it was I was one of the few students who had my full period of education, the full 5 years under the professorship of Izzy Metstein, one of the founders of Gillespie Kidd and Coyle with Andy McMillan, and you know who was absolutely the most extraordinary of teachers. You know, again, you know, in a very different way to Michael, who was so sort of urbane and sophisticated. It's not to say, I mean, Izzy was a very sophisticated man, but, you know, Izzy did a lot of his business, you know, in the pub with a bottle of Macallan. But, you know, for us students, it was just absolutely an extraordinary education. And I think that also, you know, along with, you know, the impact of Michael, the impact of John, you know, those are, and Jamie, those are the sort of, you know, key characters, I think, you know, in my architectural education.
And then, I was sort of interested really in some of the work McCaslin are known for. I mean, McCaslin have quite an international practice, which I guess you've taken on here, a lot of international projects.
Yeah, to a degree. Yes, in a specialist way.
Right. And then, but a respect for engineering, you think, in a lot of John McCaslin's work, and that clearly comes through in a lot of the work. Was that picked up there, do you think, that kind of engineering, or was that, you know, where did that sort of come from?
I think probably that was that probably was something I gained from that experience of working with John, probably subliminally.
Yeah.
We didn't have a lot of, when I was there, we didn't have a lot of conversation about the kind of origins of the designs, but you know, that was always, you know, a very clear starting point for John and for Jamie Troughton as well. Jamie in particular, I think, you know, is a firm believer in, you know, the sort of pragmatics of architecture, and you know, that being the sort of leading tool when you start designing a building. So I think there was a lot learnt from that. Yeah.
Jamie trained as an architect.
He did. But although I think his grandfather or great grandfather was John Fowler, who designed the Forth Rail Bridge.
Right. Okay.
So you know, he came from a firm engineering background. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then, so you, when you founded your practice, was there? What sort of work was there? I mean, were you looking for? What did you gain? What was the, it was kind of high end resi. Was it kind of residential work?
I did have some residential projects.
Okay.
And I did those for sort of 2 or 3 years. And then I had a project to do up an apartment for an American couple in Maida Vale. They both worked at different sort of really high pressured American banks. So this is, you know, like late 90s, you know, working for American banks in Canary Wharf, young married couple doing up their apartment. And I suddenly realized that the only times they saw each other were when they met me. And they used that as a means by which to argue with each other.
Right. Yeah, marriage counselor.
And it was, exactly. Yeah. And I'm sure this is an experience that a lot of architects who do resi work have. And I just thought, I'm not sure if this is a place I want to inhabit for too much longer. So my residential experience was relatively short-lived, actually.
Right.
And then I kind of made a, at that stage, semi-conscious, although now it's a very conscious decision not to do any more resi work. And actually, once you make that decision and you stop taking the jobs, of course, then you don't have the experience or the portfolio, so people don't give them to you.
Yeah.
And that's inevitably what happens.
You start getting more commercial work, and that breeds more.
What I was lucky about was, A, getting that TUC project early on, you know, doing up the toilets.
Yeah.
and then my mother-in-law at that time was a trustee of the Girl Guide Association.
Right.
And so one of their members, the lady who was responsible for South Wimbledon, they were looking to rebuild their Girl Guide hut in South Wimbledon. So they went to the trust saying, oh, who should we use? And my name fortuitously bubbled to the top.
I'd be disappointed if it didn't, wouldn't you?
That would have been. So I got this job. And at the beginning, it was to help them to get a grant from the National Lottery Charities Board for building a new Girl Guide headquarters in South Wimbledon, which is actually a totally landlocked site. So in London, you get these blocks, these sort of garden areas, which are the kind of residue of where everybody else's back garden comes together. And it was on one of those sites, and there was a nursery. You walked down this path past a small nursery building, and then you came to the Girl Guides building, and it had been built in the early 60s, it was a timber building, and now the squirrels had made their home in the roof, and it was collapsing. So we put together a scheme and applied for a National Lottery Charities Board grant, which they got, and then they had to raise the remainder of the funding from selling cakes, which was an amazing achievement. They did do that.
Right.
And so that was a kind of new building ongoing alongside doing things like the TUC's toilets.
Right.
And that was, we finished that, I finished that in 1999. And it was a long, long journey. I think it was my lowest earning fee per hour I've ever done. But we did get an RIBA award and a Civic Trust award from it. So I think it was worthwhile.
Just about makes it worthwhile.
Totally did.
And you, you've said elsewhere when you, when you won the competition for the Antarctic Research Centre, that was the largest building at the time you had you'd completed for the practice.
By a long shot. I think actually at the stage we won that project, the Girl Guides building, which cost £160,000, was the largest new build project we had completed. There may have been one or two refurbs which were bigger than that.
But as a new build.
But as a new building, that was definitely the biggest. But they didn't ask, what's your biggest project?
You didn't volunteer.
And it was quite interesting. That was a really interesting part of the competition, in fact, because, you know, within the expression of interest, not a great deal of the pre-qualification questionnaire was oriented towards your previous experience.
Right.
Because I think the British Antarctic Survey realised that nobody actually had the specific experience that they were looking for. Right. That was something you were going to have to develop in partnership with them.
Yeah.
Obviously, we entered with ACOM, who at that stage was Faber-Maunsell, and there were guys in their team who had polar experience, so we could record that. But as architects, they were looking for people who were going to be innovative.
Yeah.
So we put in scheme. We had done a totally speculative scheme for an exhibition at the Building Centre, demonstrating how light, when combined with a, you know, when different types of light colour are combined together, they make, you know, different lights. And when you turn all of them on, they make white. And, and it was a sort of structure that we got everything made for nothing. Yeah. And it was actually rather a beautiful thing. We did it with Spears and Major. And we put things like that in as our examples of our work. So actually, not only was it very low value, it was actually free. But I think British Antarctic Survey were looking for a big engineering, you know, company where they could feel entirely safe, and then innovation, because they'd had standard solutions to their previous five buildings, and now they wanted new approaches. And it was quite interesting how that sort of combination seemed to resonate with them, because they had lots of applications from people who'd built, you know, big, grand, and you know, worldwide respected structures. So we were kind of the maverick combination, I suppose, that they also wanted in the mix.
from the practice, what led you to applying? I mean, competitions are notoriously time consuming and often low, people apply for lots of competitions, low chance of winning, but with huge, obviously, kind of opportunities if you win. What led you to apply for Halley?
Well, we didn't have very much work at the time.
So you had a bit of time.
So we had the time.
Right.
So that was good.
Yeah.
And that is really important, I think. You know, I think all too often, it was an expression of interest that you had to submit, but it was quite a detailed one. I think there was 15 pages of response to the project brief. And there's no point in applying for any competition which has that kind of requirement if you haven't got the time to think about it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to demonstrate that you have thought long and hard about the issues at stake.
Yeah.
So I think that was, you know, we had the time. Obviously, it was pretty beguiling, the idea of building a building in the Antarctic. I'm quite an outdoorsy kind of person. I love nature and the natural environment, so that was encouraging. I suppose it was just those kind of features. I can't say that we entered thinking, oh, that's one we might win.
Yeah.
I think we realised it would be an experience just to enter it.
Yeah.
But, you know, out of these dreams, you know, come reality. So we were. It worked out.
I mean, those competitions, thinking about kind of Rogers and the Pompidou Centre and those, you know, for so many practices, the competition win is formative, I guess, in the kind of direction of the practice.
Yeah.
And then at what stage I'm sure people listening will have seen or have a view in their mind's eye of the research centre with its stilts. That it was movable was, I guess, one of the kind of conditions, one part of the brief. At what stage did the sort of form take, you know, did you have an idea of that when you entered the competition, or was that something, you know, when did that, you know, when and how did that structure come about?
Yeah, the British Antarctic Survey have always maintained that it was clear from the very beginning that the building needed to be fully relocatable, but I don't remember that from the from initial pre-qualification process. We did do a little drawing within our submission which said either it could be a big structure or it could be made up of lots of little structures. But definitely after we got to the final six, Faber-Mansell invited over a guy from their American office who had worked on projects at the South Pole for most of his career, a fantastic guy called Craig Martin, now retired. And Craig came over and spent 2 days with us before the sort of second stage launch event at the British Antarctic Survey and told us everything about his experiences. And then we went to the launch, and then that evening in my hotel room, I sort of sketched out the idea of a kind of module on legs.
Right.
And the next day, we sort of built upon that. You know, significant changes took place through the design process of, you know, introducing hydraulic legs and things like that. But the idea of a string of buildings as modules, I think I have a sketch from, you know, the launch was on the 1st of September, from the 2nd of September, which showed a string of modules connected together. At that stage, we were thinking maybe all of them could be two-storey, but in the end, only the main central one is two-storey. But the principle, interestingly, was established very, very early on.
And that principle has been, you've done other work for the Spanish, Juan Carlos Research Centre for Spain, which has a similar
No, that doesn't have hydraulic legs. It has legs, but not hydraulic legs,
right.
Because that's the reason why the Halley station has hydraulic legs is because the snow level constantly rises,
right.
So the legs retract inside themselves, and then you can push snow underneath and then use the hydraulics to jack it up above the rising snow level.
Right.
But on the site of the Spanish station, it's on an island, Livingston Island, where they get massive snowfall, but it melts every summer.
Right.
So there the legs are just fixed legs with a foundation. But the image is similar.
Yeah,
I'm quite conscious of that. And interestingly, there was about 2 years ago, there was a competition for the new Brazilian station, Comandante Ferraz, which had just burnt down, so they were replacing it. And unfortunately, when the Brazilians gave all the documentation for the competition. They also included a section on precedence with a detailed study of Halley and of Juan Carlos. And so, you know, well, we didn't win, and I don't want to sound bitter about losing a competition, but, you know, all the entries look like our designs. Yeah. And so you do become conscious and think, it's a sort of an inspiration, actually. Yeah. You have to start thinking, hold on a minute, these projects are not about legs and cladding. Yeah. They're about creating the perfect environment for that setting for people to conduct world-class science. Yeah. And that's got to be where you start from. Yeah. And it may be, you know, at Halley, I'm convinced still that the solution we came up with, the modular solution on the legs and skis, was absolutely perfect for meeting that requirement. Yeah. But, you know, if you're looking at another station, it could be a wholly different solution. It might be a very traditional pitched roof timber frame building that would be better in that location. Yeah. So, which of course is the way that an architect should work. These, they're sort of products, but they don't, you know, they should only be products if that's what the brief requires. They should be different kinds of buildings if that's what the setting and the brief requires. There's no one size fits all for polar research stations.
But I suppose it's so iconic an image now.
It is, yeah.
That's what people think.
I know.
So in a sense, not only have you designed the building, but you've designed the typology, really.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the credit for that has to go to the British Antarctic Survey, because it's not a natural decision to have an international design competition for a building in that kind of location. So, you know, that was a big leap into the dark. And a lot of that credit goes to, there are two people particularly at BAS who led that process. And one was Lyndon de Kapper, who was their head of communications, who's absolutely fantastic still there. And the other was Professor Chris Rapley, who was their, the director of the British Antarctic Survey at the time. And, you know, he was kind of putting his neck on the line by saying, you know, let's go for this bold move. Yeah. When up until then, everybody else had used, you know, equivalents of the Royal Engineers, or, you know, certainly they had been only engineering-led solutions. Yeah. But I think they really have benefited from that leap of faith. Yeah. And, you know, they've ended up with a building which they can relocate. So, you know, that's been already proven as a success, but also a really great working environment, which is fostering science, which previously they had been unable to accommodate on the station. Okay. But because they took that leap of faith and then we produced that building, it's then sort of, I guess, led to other countries thinking, oh, look, architecture can play a role in the design of buildings in the Antarctic. And there's a whole generation now of new bases which have come about. I mean, Juan Carlos is one, but there's a firm of architects in Hamburg, Boff Architekten, who've done a beautiful station for the Indians, Bharati. There's a firm in Hawaii, Ferraro Choi, who, well, they had already were already working on the South Pole, but it's a, you know, very elegant looking building. There are, you know, a number of other countries which have started to embrace the role of architecture in the polar regions.
Wow. Okay.
And I think, you know, that Halley had a big part to play in that change.
Yeah. I suppose there's naturally a lot of focus on the form of the research centre and its function in terms of, you know, being movable. But a lot of the work, I guess, of the architects is to outsiders, the unseen part, looking at how people work and how they function, how they survive in pretty otherwise, pretty bleak conditions.
That really interests me, that, you know, the whole notion of survival in, you know, very isolated communities. And, you know, what are the things that, as an architect, you can introduce to help support people in that degree of isolation? So we did a lot of work thinking about the whole way in which people live in those places, right from, you know, the moment you wake up, how do you wake up? You know, what's the difference between summer when there's 24-hour daylight and winter when it's 24-hour darkness? You know, what's the surface that you feel under your feet as you wake up and swing your feet out of bed in the morning? Do you have your own bathroom or do you share bathrooms? Yeah. What's the communal space like? Is communal space enough? You know, so we really did work almost on a kind of minute by minute basis, looking at the day and thinking about how people move about to come up. You know, that informed as well the kind of layout of the station, but at a very detailed level, selections of materials. And one of the people we included in our team was a lady called Angela Wright, who's a colour psychologist, to help us look at how colour can play a part in people's well-being, particularly when they're affected by seasonal affective disorder, which is a condition that people suffer in winter, and particularly when it's very dark. So, and interestingly, for such a sort of high-tech, science-oriented project, those architectural components were really looking back at sort of first principles to do with levels of intimacy, levels of privacy, variations in circulation route, how to introduce light into circulation and so on.
All of that could have been studied previously. You don't need any, and haven't been by the looks of things.
I think all of those, I mean, they're sort of principles that you read about in the work of people like Christopher Alexander, that those ideas of defensible space and so on. They could have been introduced before. I think also there's a sense that people approach projects in places like Antarctica slightly with blinkers on, thinking, I can't be worrying about all those things. Yeah. There's too many other challenges. Yeah. But actually, it's worrying about those things which will help to promote the best scientific research. So they're actually very important. They're not to be kind of like just bolted on at the end. Yeah. They need to be there right at the beginning of the design process.
Absolutely. It's interesting, there was, just looking through some of the photos from inside Halley, and obviously the images from outside are so striking. Mm. You don't see a lot of published photos from inside, but there's one which just reminds me of one of the scenes in Stanley Kubrick's 2001, inside a space station, and I thought the kind of low level, slightly kind of modernist sofas, and the people maybe pose but are kind of enforced because the space is limited, having a chat, kind of bumping into each other in a corridor. I thought it just struck me as really similar, really.
There is an inevitability about that to some degree. And that stems from, a number of strands, really. Yeah. We worked with this great visualizer when we were doing the competition stages for Halley 6, a guy called Chris Curtis, who once used to work at Rogers. And he and I shared a kind of passion for Star Wars.
Right.
So we used to kind of egg each other on when he was doing the images, couldn't we make it look like this scene or that scene? Yeah. So there was an element of that. Also, when we were designing Halley, my eldest son was about 6 or 7 at the time, and he was really into the Thunderbirds. Oh, yeah. And so, we had all the Thunderbirds cutaway books and so on, and actually they became the kind of go-to publication if you couldn't think out how to solve something. So I suppose there is an inevitability about the sort of space age nature of the brief that then feeds into the interior design. And it is a bit like living on a space station there. So I suppose those, similarities are hard to avoid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a kind of combination between, sort of old style architectural logic and, the futurism of space design that is involved in it.
And a real focus on how people live.
Yeah, that was really important. Honestly, I can't emphasize enough that consideration as to how people function during the day and thinking about, well, what are the deprivations that people are suffering? Obviously, there's things like light in the winter. So we did a lot of work with our lighting designer on coming up with methods of daylight simulation. And we invented with them an alarm clock which goes next to people's heads in their bed that you program, and then it wakes you up with a false dawn to help balance the serotonin and melatonin so that you can overcome the effects of seasonal affective disorder. As I said, we worked with a colour psychologist. When we were looking at things like the central staircase in the main living module, We lined it with Lebanese cedar veneer. Actually, from my experience working at the TUC, where we'd used a lot of Lebanese cedar veneer because it had been used in the 1950 version. And it's one of the few veneers that retains a pleasant smell even after, you know, a long period of time. And there's no trees, there's no vegetation in the Antarctic. So you're, you know, at least getting a nice pleasant smell. It was also thinking that, you know, of course it's great to bring the community together, but actually we don't always want to be together all the time. But you don't always want to be just in your own room. Yeah. So, you know, we developed a space at the end of the station where a small group of three or four people could get together. It was just thinking about all those social situations which would help support the community. And interestingly, after the completion of Halley, I have done a little bit of work with NASA on looking at how people might survive on a long duration mission to Mars, right. And you know, how we foster a sense of community with it without losing the rights of the individual on a program like that. And that came out of their admiration, I think, for the Halley project, because obviously the engineering on a spaceship is of a level of sophistication that's hard to imagine. But the social and psychological stressors are commonplace amongst many different isolated situations. And that's not, you know, isolated as in living in the Scottish Islands. That's isolated as in living on a nuclear submarine or in an Antarctic research station. Yeah. And there were a lot of good lessons to be learned. So actually, we did this workshop with NASA. It was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. So there were two architects, myself and a guy called Michael Morris from New York, and some psychologists, human factor experts, space engineers, and we spent, I think, 3 days just trying to work out what was the minimum volume that an astronaut needed in order to psychologically survive on a module traveling for a year to Mars. And so we went through all the different, again, it was a bit like the Antarctic station. You know, what's your sleeping space like? Yeah. You know, where's the bathroom? You know, where are the areas of maximum acoustic interruption? How much space do you need to work in? How much space do six astronauts need to come together? And at the end of it, of course, to deliver this figure, somebody had to do some drawings. So actually we did the drawings in the office of, you know, the inside of the Mars module to work out what the volume would be. And we came up with this figure of around 25 cubic meters. And at the moment, that is the working figure that people in NASA are using. And then the engineering is built around that. And that sounds obvious, but previous space modules haven't been designed like that. They've been designed more from the outside in. And then the space that's left over, you squash the astronaut into. And if you're going on a trajectory from the US or from Russia up to the space station or even to the moon, you know, your journey is quite short. But this is on an unparalleled level. If you're going to Mars, you're going to be in that module for a year. So you've got to get the human factor side of it right. And it was quite interesting how there were so many parallels with the Antarctic station and the Antarctic work and what they were looking at.
I thought the nuclear submarine aspect is interesting. I mean, I suppose that nuclear subs and the space station are the most kind of extreme space constraints of
it. Yeah, I should think so, yeah. I mean, you see, don't you, those sort of fly-on-the-wall documentaries about living in a submarine. Yeah. And, you know, that is ergonomics at the umpteenth level. You know, you're getting six guys in a tiny space, three bunks on top of each other.
And a space where you'd hope well-being was somewhat considered, given the problems you might have on a nuclear sub otherwise.
Maybe.
I suppose that the obvious question from the research into how people live and light and survival, the obvious question is how much of that comes back to other work that you do in less kind of extreme circumstances. So more recently work on the Henry Moore Foundation and quite an interesting use of light, would you say, natural daylight, as a kind of celebration of some of that coming back into your work after
maybe
such challenging
It's a question I wrangle with, you know, what is the connection between all these different projects. And you know, because maybe one's trying to look for a theme. I'm not sure if there is one. I think it stems perhaps right back to the beginning. Why did we enter the Antarctic Research Station? And it's because I have a, you know, this passion for, you know, the outdoors and the natural environment. So, and that way in which a building connects with its natural environment is really important to me. So therefore one's seeing a response in the Antarctic Research Station, and one might see a similar response or reverence recurring in some of these other projects. I also have a fascination with the idea of the skylight. Right. So on the basis that when you look through a skylight, you see the sky and you see the motion and the kinetic energy of the sky, yeah, without any other physical encumbrance. Right. And it's a slightly transcendental experience for us all, I think. There's nothing better than a just pure framed view of sky. Mm. And that is a theme, again, that, you know, recurs in quite a lot of our projects. Of course, added to that, there's, you know, we've gained a lot of understanding in, you know, ergonomics, in energy efficiency, in air sealed building systems, mm, that are probably unseen in the designs, yeah, but do come to play to a degree in the projects. It's interesting, the numbers of times when I'm sitting with a client, it won't happen often, but for sure, a few times in the life of every project, I'll go, well, when we did the Antarctic station, we did this. Yeah. And they'll go, well, that's an interesting solution. Yeah. Let's try that. And it's often things like just construction technique and so on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely permeates things. But so also, an experience we might have had in an art gallery hopefully will permeate into the design of an Antarctic research station.
So I suppose there's a big arc of your work is on kind of cultural projects and on...
Mm. I think we're finding increasingly, for better or worse, that our work is sort of splitting between two kind of areas. And I wouldn't say it was polar, it's more like now it's kind of remote because... alongside the work in the polar regions, we've recently done a health centre on Tristan da Cunha. We're currently working with Galifer Try, who built the Halley Antarctic Research Station. We're working with them on a project in St Kilda off the coast of Scotland. So remote is one field. And then the other field, it's a kind of broad sector, but yeah, sort of heritage cultural sector, but, you know, new interventions within historic settings.
Right.
Primarily, you know, for visitor experiences. Yeah. But they, you know, for example, the TUC is a Grade 2 star listed building.
Yeah, yeah.
Still working with that. But that's environment and settings is a key theme through all the projects, I think.
And then I suppose we haven't really talked about kind of construction methods and kind of new construction methods.
Mm.
And that.
Well, not just construction methods, but I am. Absolutely passionate about the importance of detail in buildings.
Right.
So, we have done one or two buildings where we've been asked just to do them to, you know, planning stage.
Yeah.
And I find it unbelievably unrewarding.
Right.
Because when I was at Edinburgh, I always remember Ted Cullinan used to be the visiting professor. And Ted... but certainly when he came to teach us, was a very keen advocate of the idea of designing at 1 to 100 or 1 to 200 and 1 to 1 yeah, simultaneously. So even when you're doing the feasibility study, right, you know, at 1 to 500, say, you have in mind, you know, the construction or the detail. Mm. So that what you're doing has this element of realism about it,
yeah,
to be useful.
Yeah.
And I've always... been a really firm believer in that approach, and so when your role is cut off, it's a bit like having an arm cut off or something like that. It's like you're not delivering the full gambit of what your thinking has been about the project. So construction is bound into that.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point in designing a building if you don't know how it's going to get put together.
Yeah.
But even in the putting together, you have to think about how. So it's, you know, corners, for example. Mm-hmm. Where architecture is made and lost,
yeah,
in my opinion. You know, if you don't get the corners right,
yeah,
you know, the whole thing starts falling apart.
Yeah.
So that sort of craftsmanship and connections is really something which enthuses me.
I suppose literally falls apart in some of
yeah,
the more,
I guess so. In the worst cases.
Extreme
yeah.
parts of the world.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose that move then from polar, you know, it's a limited market into more...
Seems to have its peaks and troughs, I have to say.
Right.
Yeah.
Into more remote, a kind of broader sense of remote buildings.
Mm.
How much, architects maybe famously love travelling. We talked a bit at the beginning
yeah, they
about
do,
travelling.
Don't they?
And you've presumably visited, how much travel do you get? I mean, how much do you
it's kind of varies. Travel? Actually, one of the best ways of travelling recently has been, I've done a numbers of kind of lecture trips to different places, which I'm always really keen about. Yeah. It probably is exactly as you say, because architects like travelling. Yeah. And probably the reason architects like travelling is twofold. One is because they get to visit other places which are inspirational and allow them to think about the whole nature of design and how it impacts upon their own work, but also because it buys you time for that thoughtfulness.
Yeah.
Which I think is incredibly important. You know, you can't, you know, the delivery of buildings in the UK, for example, requires the drawing together of so many strands. And I'm sure many people would understand now how complex, for example, planning is.
Yeah.
You know, planning now constitutes 20, 30 different documents in some occasions. So, you know, there's very little time available for the kind of just clear thinking process. So I find, you know, the odd trip now and again is very enlightening in that respect. But I think otherwise it's, you know, seeing other cultures, seeing the way people react to different things. And through that, I mean, I have got to visit some great locations. Yeah. Last year, one of my trips that I enjoyed the most was going to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I did about 10 days doing a series of talks in Alaska. For the American Institute of Architects and also for the Alaska Design Forum. And I really, really enjoyed that. The whole approach of the people there, you know, that everyone was so, it was so unbelievably friendly. The scenery is absolutely stunning. But also, you know, just the opportunities to talk about, you know, designing in that kind of environment with people I found really interesting. And I did probably the most exciting lecture I've ever done, which was outside of Fairbanks, to the Alaska Design Forum there. It was absolutely packed out.
Yeah.
It was the best attended of all the lectures. And it was in a kind of concert venue in a sort of glorified Nissan hut. And it was used for lectures, for concerts. It had a bar.
Yeah.
All round the lecture space was just tables where people could prop themselves up having a beer while they were listening to you. And I was on stage, and the previous person who'd been on stage before me was Snoop Doggy Dogg. So it was just absolutely brilliant.
Someone to follow.
Wow. Yeah.
Do you think the American approach, I mean, I suppose a newer country and more of a kind of maybe a frontier aspect in America, do you think there's a different approach to new buildings in America?
One of the we did this project with... for the American National Science Foundation, doing a laboratory in Greenland. And one of the things that I found so refreshing about doing that project is that the design team were responsible for the design from the concept to the very last screw and bolt.
Right.
There was no contractor design permitted on that project.
Okay.
And I found that really refreshing, because that is the way we like to do our work in our office.
Yeah.
That's why I say, you know, when we only get commissioned to do a project up to planning, I find it so unrewarding. And in America, you know, there does seem to be, maybe it was just my experience on that job, I don't know enough about the industry there, but I did enjoy the fact that we were responsible for the design right to the finest level of detail. And I think that I do find it a shame in the UK the way there is more and more of a move towards contractor design for so many components of a project.
Yeah. And so maybe thinking a little bit about the future, say you're 14, did you say, 14 people as a practice, in terms of projects coming up, what projects have you got coming up? Where's the practice going?
Yeah. I mean, actually... right at the moment, the biggest project we've got on at the moment is working for one of the Inns of Court, the Inner Temple, where we're creating an education centre for pupil barristers, which has been a very contentious project because it involves significant changes to their library, which has engendered a lot of passions, both for and against. That's a big project ongoing at the moment. We have another contentious project, so we seem to be in the contentious period, doing a project for English Heritage at Clifford's Tower in York, which was a project we won through a competition, has planning consent, but has again engendered passions on both sides. We're, as I mentioned before, we're working with Galifer Try, who we delivered the Antarctic Station on a project in St Kilda. We're doing a beautiful project in the Painted Hall, designed by Christopher Wren in Greenwich, which is conserving the paintings but also introducing new visitor facilities. That's an HLF-funded project, which will open in 2019. And we've started working again with the British Antarctic Survey on their sort of long-term framework on projects within the Antarctic estate. So there's quite a few, you know, there's a quite a sort of variety, and 21 years on, still working with the TUC. So there's quite a sort of variety. But interestingly, just in the last few weeks, actually, there have been a few inquiries coming in about other polar projects, some of them really quite dynamic and exciting. So we'll see how those pan out. Yeah, the Brexit thing is kind of worrying. You know, all the reports that you're reading in, you know, the architectural press and in the national press about the impacts on the UK economy, and they, you know, whether they have effects on the kind of contemporary intervention in historic setting sector that we do a lot of our work in, I don't know. But what we found in the recession is that you got a lot more pressure from other architectural practices within that sector, because whilst it may have stood up, others may have collapsed. So people start moving between things. So I think, you know, you definitely need, you need strands. That's one of the key messages that I'm sure everybody learned from the recession, is you cannot survive on specialism in just one or two areas. You need to have a few irons in the fire, that's for sure. You know, although we do certain things, I've always thought of us as like a kind of general practice, you know, and I think that's a very important characteristic, particularly when times are tough.
You mentioned earlier then about contentious projects, and I suppose that's a thing a lot of architects will share, is dealing with controversial or contentious projects.
Oh yeah, I've really enjoyed reading that we're not alone since then. So I've seen a number of other people, you know, very prestigious practices, you know, also facing, you know, backlashes of public opinion. Yeah, I think it sort of comes with the territory a bit, doesn't it? You know, and to some degree, to be working on projects which do stir up passions should be seen as a reward, not a hindrance to one's career. But, you know, it is demanding, and in definitely the two cases we have, so it should be. You know, they're very responsible projects, you know, and particularly, for example, Clifford's Tower is a 13th century stone ruin sitting on a grassy mound in the centre of York, one of our most historic cities. And so how you treat that and deal with that is of massive significance. So I do have a lot of sympathy for those who may question the approach we've taken. But the approach we've taken has come out of an extraordinary amount of research and discussion with many, many different bodies, you know, and that's only right for that type of site.
Interested, I mean, partly interested maybe about how people deal with that on a personal level. You know, there's something about a kind of, not battle so much, but about, you know, whether it's wearing and how people kind of, but I was also interested, I suppose, in, you know, the kind of emotional side of working in a practice is maybe competition, not so much competition wins, but competition losses, maybe, that we hear so much about practices that have been defined by a competition win. And you hear very little, certainly from architects, talking about what, in a sense, what might have been competitions they might have won. And how, presumably for every competition an architect enters, there's a number that they don't win. You know, the kind of numbers must
yeah, I think there was an RABA survey recently, and it was, I can't remember, was it 1 in 12 or right. Certainly no more than 1 in 10 yeah. that people are winning. Yeah. So yeah, for every one win, there's 9 losses.
And how do people? Yeah, you must get excited in order to enter a competition. How do you think architects deal with what must be disappointment?
I honestly can tell you that every time we lose, it is a crushing blow. I take it quite kind of personally, because you put a lot of your personality into the project, and I find that for a few days afterwards it's hard to focus, because I take it, it's a really, and that I think now influences how many we go in for, how strong am I feeling for that level of failure. And that is the way I think you feel about it. I think we've had periods where we seem to have had a golden touch and we've won 2 or 3 in a row. And you think, wow, that's an incredible thing. But don't worry, there's failure is only round the corner.
If you start getting complacent.
And hopefully, though, there are ideas that you take out of each one.
Yeah.
I think that's very hard to appreciate at the time, you do.
Yeah.
And I do find myself, as we embark upon a project, going, do you know what? We had a really nice idea.
Yeah.
We may not have won, but that was a nice idea that we can, adapt and introduce to another project.
Yeah.
I think there's a benefit in it. It's certainly... is exciting for the people in the office as well when we're working on a competition, but probably also equally demoralising when you don't win. And there are definitely a few in there that I look back up and I think back on and I think, God, if only that would have been really a great project to have won. Yeah. But it's sort of unfair to mention them, isn't it? Because someone else did win them. and then you're sort of undermining their response.
Yeah.
But there are definitely some that I look at and we think, wow, that was really great.
But as I say, I think it's not talked about often.
No,
yeah,
it isn't, is it?
A winner
and it's I think definitely afterwards that it's afterwards that I find myself looking on the web for things like these facts of how many other people, how many people score, and how many they let in, as you know what I mean. And it obviously is something that is affecting a lot of people a lot of the time. And there's the emotional side to it, but also there's the financial side to it.
Yeah.
They are incredibly expensive to enter.
Yeah.
My view is it probably costs us, for a design competition, where you're shortlisted 1 of 5 and then you have to produce a design, 20, 30 grand minimum for each one. So when you lose, that's a big ticket item.
Yeah.
And, how many other professions do people have to go through that many hoops to win their commissions? I always look back at all the ones we did, and obviously one has slightly rose-tinted spectacles looking at the ones that you won.
Yeah.
But there have been some that we've won that I think the client has ended up absolutely with a great outcome, and their selection process was not too onerous.
Mm.
So, for example, the Painted Hall in Greenwich, there was no design asked for, but there was a kind of response.
Yeah.
It did take effort.
Yeah.
We definitely committed 2 weeks of time to, and I did do some sketches over a weekend, but we didn't have to do a full-blown design. It's the full-blown design, for us in particular, I find, because we can't stop. We're very bad at knowing when to stop.
Yeah.
We also did a project for the Institution of Structural Engineers, and they had a competitive interview between 3 practices. And from the moment the inquiry came in to the moment you sat in front of the interview panel, there was 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So then you had to give your fee at the end of week 1 and turn up at the interview at the end of week 2. And in 2 weeks, there's only a limit. It's definitely going to be stuffed with felt pens.
Yeah.
And, I really think that through an hour-long interview and seeing those sketches, they were able to determine an approach.
Yeah.
But they were also still had plenty of room to work with us to get the response that they wanted.
Yeah.
And I think that we ended up with a really nice project as a consequence. So, I don't know. I mean, I wonder sometimes whether we're our own worst enemies in promoting competitions which are requiring far too much information and to an extent, therefore, denying the interaction between architect and client, which is so important in the final product.
Which leads to, I mean, like the British Antarctic Survey, you know, leads to, you know, there's no design done up front. You know, that comes with work with the client.
I suppose, I mean, with the British Antarctic Survey, obviously that was a full-blown competition. There was a lot of access to the client during the competition process. And I dare say it wasn't true for the other competitors, but for us, the competition in its own right was the biggest fee we had ever earned. So whereas the others may have been, I mean, we would have been mortally unhappy if we hadn't won that competition. Yeah. But nonetheless, the fee we got for entering the competition was better than anything else we'd ever earned.
Somewhere there is a practice, someone probably thinking over competitions, not won someone's ideas. They think, oh, if only I'd, you know, the practice might have gone a completely different way.
Exactly, exactly.
When are you next off to the Antarctic? When are you?
I don't know. One day, I hope. Yeah.
And you don't wish it was somewhere? I mean, you're obviously used to the cold.
Do you know what? We did this project with Galliford Try that was finished this year.
Right.
It's a really low-key, simple building, which is a health centre on Tristan da Cunha, which is the world's most remote inhabited island. And it's got a population of 280.
Yeah.
It is 10 days sailing from Cape Town on a fishing trawler, which only makes the journey 6 or 8 times in the year.
Yeah.
So unbelievably remote. Yeah. Sadly, I never got to visit. And we designed this health facility there. It's got an operating theatre. It's only got 2 beds, but it's got all the facilities that's needed, really. It was this pre-engineered timber flat pack building that we designed with a company in Sweden. And so we saw everything in Sweden before it was exported to Tristan da Cunha. But I would have loved to have made the visit there.
That must be a record, never seeing the final building.
Yeah, it must
building.
Be, you know, must be, mustn't it? Yeah. And never having visited, I think, not necessarily not having seen the finished building, but never to have visited the site.
Yeah,
slightly disappointing that. But having said that, I have seen the photos and it fits in very well in its setting.
Yeah.
And the people on the island are really enjoying the building. So, yeah, I think it's been a success, but I'm not sure it's the way to go in terms of architecture.
Well, let's hope your next lunar base provides more of an opportunity for visiting.
Oh, my God, I don't know about that.
That's great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Hugh. That's really...
I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, Owen.
Thanks again.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. My guest this week has been Hugh Broughton. You can find out more about Hugh and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions to hello@architecturemasters.org. That was this week's Architecture Masters with me, Owen Wainhouse.